So good morning, everybody, including those in the Zoom Pure Land. Hello. My name is Claire. My Dharma name is Joko. I've been practicing with Mountain Rain for coming up to 30 years now, which has been a great privilege and joy. It's actually getting close to half my life, which is amazing. So welcome to the Heart Sutra Part 2. I have to confess that when I was invited to do a talk on the Heart Sutra and just a portion of the Heart Sutra, a third of it, I thought, yeah, well, how hard could that be? I mean, it's a short sutra. I've chanted it many times. I know it by heart. And then when I slowed down and started to study it, I lost my cockiness. And by the time I got to my last line of my portion, I was like, phew. And you've got the Heart Sutra that is on page 4 of your chant books. If you'd like to kind of have it out, you can refer to it as we go along. And I'd just like to thank you for sharing this opportunity with me to look into the Heart Sutra and gain some understanding and appreciation for its teaching and power. So my Dharma sister Flo set the scene for the sutra last week in part 1. And a sutra is a scripture that relates a teaching of the Buddha. The Heart Sutra is likely the most frequently recited text in East Asian Buddhism. And no one really knows who wrote it or even when and where it was written. Could have been India or China from the reading I did, and probably several hundred years after the Buddha's death. And there have been many translations and commentaries written about it. And we're fortunate to have some contemporary ones written in English. And I'm going to refer to and quote from three of these authors today. So Thich Nhat Hanh, a beloved Vietnamese monk who recently died, is well known for his clear and simple way of presenting the Dharma. And I have his book. He calls it A New Translation of the Heart Sutra with Commentaries. And I think it was published in 2012. And he wrote it with some sort of new interpretations of words. And he says that he feels that some of the previous translations may have been misleading with the use of the word empty. Quite interesting. And then Shohaku Okamura is a Japanese Soto Zen priest who trained originally in Japan and then came to the United States and lives in Indiana right now and teaches. And in fact, he was the original teacher for Kate and Michael when they studied in Japan. And I've got his book, Living by Vow, which explores some of the key sutras and chants that we use. And Red Pine is an American author who lives in Port Townsend, Washington, so not very far away. His English name is Bill Porter, and he translates Chinese texts, Taoist and Buddhist, and his book is called The Heart Sutra. I found them all very helpful. And it's interesting to look at different translations and commentaries, as the original words can be understood in different ways, and they've come down to us through many cultures and times. So Red Pine describes the Heart Sutra as Buddhism in a nutshell, as it covers more of the Buddhist teachings in a shorter span than any other scripture. And these teachings were given to us to help us see the nature of our existence, our experience of incarnation in this world, of being here. And in the sutra, Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, introduces the teaching of the perfection of wisdom to the Buddha's wisest disciple, Shariputra. The perfection of wisdom, or the highest wisdom, is the ability to see the emptiness and interdependence of all phenomena. So in the sutra, Avalokiteshvara goes systematically through the most fundamental early teachings of the Buddha and points out how they can be ineffective if taken as knowledge rather than wisdom. And knowledge in this case is information or fact that one grasps as truth, whereas wisdom is the way of seeing reality beyond the scope of words. The parable of the finger pointing to the moon tells us to look at the moon, not the finger. And it's thought that the early Buddhists wanted to understand and preserve the teachings of the Buddha and perhaps got too caught up in the words, not seeing what they were pointing to. And Avalokiteshvara takes this opportunity to reorient Shariputra. So in my years of practice with Mountain Rain, this is the sutra I have chanted the most often, as it's part of most of our services. And I've learned to appreciate the practice of chanting as a way to immerse not just my mind, but my body in the teachings. There's something about the steady rhythm and tone that allows the vibration of my voice and those around me to penetrate my cells. So my mind often tries to catch a phrase or two and make sense of it. And then when it can't, spiral off either into judgments about the words or about me, or into trying to figure it out. And I'm getting better at catching myself and returning just to the sound of the words as they are chanted. And I always hope that there is something sinking in. So as Flo described last week in part one, the main teaching of the Heart Sutra is emptiness. And this is hard to express in words or concepts. The sutra is not saying that we don't exist, but that we don't exist in the way we think we do. So in part one, which is the first lines that you see there, we're told that the five skandhas are empty. And these are the aggregates of form, sensation, perception, formation, and consciousness. And we're also told that all dharmas are marked by emptiness. The concept of emptiness here refers to the fact that they are ever-changing, impermanent, and interdependent. They are free of any independent self-nature. Thanks. So just a review, because I'm going to focus more on the next part, but and feel free to chat with me if you like. Let's go through the first lines. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when deeply practicing Prajna Paramita, clearly saw that all five aggregates are empty and thus relieved all suffering. Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form itself is emptiness, emptiness itself form. Sensations, perceptions, formations, and consciousness are also like this. Shariputra, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. They neither arise nor cease, are neither defiled nor pure, neither increase nor decrease.
That's
the end of part one. Okay. So, in part two, the sutra goes on to state that the same is true of the 12 abodes of sensation, the 18 realms of perception, the 12 links of interdependent origination, and the Four Noble Truths, as well as knowledge and attainment. And it says that in emptiness, none of these teachings exist. So this is known as the Two Truths Doctrine that says, teachings, while accurate descriptions of conventional truth, are only statements about reality, not reality itself. So they are therefore not applicable to the ultimate truth that is beyond mental understanding. And Buddhists distinguish three levels of wisdom. There's lots of lists and levels and numbers in Buddhist teachings. So three levels of wisdom, and of course we all aspire to them, being wise. So the first is called mundane wisdom, of which we all abound. And this is where we see what is permanent as what we see what is impermanent as permanent, what has no self as having a self, and what is impure as pure. And this is how most of us understand and live our lives. So the next level is called metaphysical wisdom, which sounds pretty cool. And that's what sees, which sees what appears to be permanent as impermanent, what appears to be pure as impure, and what appears to have a self as having no self. And then there's a third level, which is called transcendent wisdom, which views all things, whether mundane or metaphysical, as neither permanent nor impermanent, neither pure nor impure, and neither having a self nor not having a self. So nothing to hold on to and form a view or opinion about. And I think Avalokiteshvara is trying to nudge Shariputra from metaphysical to transcendent wisdom in this sutra. So what is emptiness? And Thich Nhat Hanh gives a delightful analogy in his book, The Other Shore. I'm just going to read that. You kind of have to talk about it with, you know, images and analogies and metaphors. So he says, if I'm holding a cup of water and I ask you, is this cup empty? You will say, no, it is full of water. But if I pour out the water and ask you again, you may say, now it is empty. But empty of what? Empty means empty of something. The cup cannot be empty of nothing. Empty doesn't mean anything unless you know empty of what. The cup is empty of water, but it is not empty of air. So to be empty is to be empty of something. This is quite a discovery. Therefore, when Avalokiteshvara claims that the five skandhas are equally empty, we must ask, dear Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, empty of what? And kind of squeeze that a bit more. It is precisely because our body is emptiness that it can manifest. Our body is full of everything, full of life. The word emptiness shouldn't scare us. It's a wonderful word. To be empty doesn't mean to be non-existent. The cup, in order to be empty, has to be there. In the same way, the body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness, in order to be empty of a separate self, have to be there. So saying this body itself is emptiness does not mean that your body does not exist. In another of his books, he's done a couple on the Heart Sutra, and I like his way of explaining things, so I'm going to focus on it a bit. So in another book, Awakening of the Heart, he says, form is the wave, and emptiness is the water. A wave on the ocean has a beginning and an end, a birth and a death. But Avalokiteshvara tells us that the wave is empty. The wave is full of water, but it is empty of a separate self. A wave is a form that has been made possible thanks to the existence of wind and water. If a wave only sees its form, with its beginning and end, it will be afraid of birth and death. But if the wave sees that it is water, and identifies itself with the water, then it will be emancipated from birth and death. Each wave is born and is going to die, but the water is free from birth and death. So, just to repeat some of the lines that are probably the most famous from this chant. Form itself is emptiness, emptiness itself form. So I like the ring of these words. And I found it easier to relate to the first half of this duo here. Form itself is emptiness. So we know from science that if we look deeper and deeper into objects, indeed, there is nothing but space and vibration and patterns. And it's so amazing that the Buddha, centuries before we had electron microscopes, realized this. So the corollary, emptiness itself form. How does that work? There is, or was, a house across the street from me that in the course of a few hours, under the attack of a huge excavator, just disappeared. What had seemed like a solid duplex with many people living in it for years was suddenly just a pile of rubble. Now, granted, they were renters, so they were coming and going all the time, so there was impermanence there, but it was still looked pretty solid. It was quite shocking. And then now there's an empty lot, an empty space, and yet there are plans and permits and architectural drawings, builders, lumber, concrete, and from that emptiness, another house is emerging. And my daughter is pregnant, and this miracle of where another human being emerges from emptiness, is unfolding right before my eyes. I hear the heartbeat, see the ultrasound, see the emerging belly bump. Oh, emptiness itself form. So my teacher, Norman Fisher, told me that knowing me, he can see that I find it easier to relate to that first part, form itself as emptiness. Because there can be a place of escape or refuge in it. Somehow, it doesn't really matter what we do or create or what happens. It's all emptiness anyway, and it will all be absolved. But emptiness itself is form. And that it seems that there's more potential and more responsibility. So I'm still kind of pondering this, how to balance and hold these dualities. But whatever our personalities and styles and penchants are, there is in ourselves and in our lives, unmistakably, a constant flow of being and non-being, coming and going, now and then. And an essential aspect of the emptiness teaching in Buddhism is that there is no separate or abiding self. Everything is connected and dependent on everything else. Nothing exists independently in a vacuum. So Thich Nhat Hanh is kind of famous for coining the beautiful phrase interbeing. And to quote from him again from The Other Shore, "I often say, to be or not to be, that is no longer the question. The question is one of interbeing." Beautiful summary. So now to get back to the sutra part two, starting after the phrase, neither increase nor decrease. Therefore, given emptiness, there is no form, no sensation, no perception, no formation, no consciousness.
No eyes.
Like a conductor. So here Avalokiteshvara repeats again that the five aggregates or skandhas are empty. And these are the ingredients of which we are made. At first glance, it would seem that the first skanda, form or rupa, refers to the body and the other four to the mind, feelings, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. So Red Pine, in his book here, he offers a more intriguing and elusive explanation. So he says, the five skandhas are not only equivalent to what we normally think of as ourselves, they are equivalent to the entire universe as we experience it. They include all of creation. The first skanda in this analysis of our awareness is rupa, or form. Rupa is not the material world. It is simply the outside world, in contrast to what we presume is an inside world. Thus, the word rupa does not actually refer to a concrete object, but to the appearance of an object. Form is like a mask that cannot be removed without revealing its own illusory identity. Such a mask might be worn by a table or a sunset or a number, a coin or a universe. Whether such things are real is not relevant. The important thing is that they make up a presumed outside to a presumed inside. An interesting way of looking at it. So that's form, and the next four skandhas are sometimes referred to as nama, or name. So rupa, or form, refers to things we know, namely the outside world. while nama, or name, refers to the means by which we know the things we know, namely the inside world. So from a Western perspective, this might be interpreted as a division into matter and mind, but it was more of a division into objective mind and subjective mind. At any rate, Avalokiteshvara clearly saw that all five aggregates are empty and thus relieved all suffering. Did that help? So the next lines apply no to the list of the six sense organs and six sense objects. So we have six senses: eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind. In Buddhism, the mind is a sense organ. And these sense organs are our window into the outer world. They allow us to receive information about the world and then to incorporate it into our consciousness to shape our view of the world. Then each sense organ has a sense object or field. For the eye, it is sight. For the ear, it is sound. The nose, smell. The body, touch. And the mind objects or thoughts. So we hear, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. When our nose interacts with a smell, it begins a cascade of reactions culminating in consciousness of a smell. Something happens in our mind, and that results in smell consciousness. So the sutra then uses a conventional shorthand, which we may be grateful for, as it eliminates a few more no's, but it is actually meaning to say, no realm of sight, no realm of sound, no realm of smell, no realm of taste, no realm of touch, and no realm of mind consciousness. So in these lists here, this compilation of the six sense organs, the six sense objects, and the six consciousnesses is then called the 18 dhatu, or 18 elements or phenomena of our lives. So these lists that we're going through now, they're meant as teachings to break down for us the parts of reality that make up our experience, and then to make it easier to see that no one part is separate and independent from any other part. So why no? No, 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 no. This sounds like a negation in saying that they don't exist. And again, we can understand this as them not existing in the way we think they do. Our way of perceiving the world is very limited. If you take, for example, smell, we can only smell a small range. Dogs can smell much more than we can. When I take my dog for a walk, he can spend 5 minutes on one bush. And I'm like, okay, I get it. There's lots more things he's taking in. Their sense of the outside world is very different from ours. And the same is true for our other senses. And yet this is our picture of reality. So when we understand that our picture is limited and distorted, an illusion, then we start to understand the meaning of emptiness. So Shohaku Okamura, in his portion on the Heart Sutra, says that everything is just illusion. The fact that we live with illusion is our reality. When we really understand this and see how illusion is caused, we can see reality through the illusion. Whatever we see, whatever we grasp with our sense organs and consciousness, is illusion. When we see this, we are released from attachment to our limited view, to what we have, to what we think we own. So in the sutra, we next move on from those 18 dhatu to the 12 links of interdependent origination, which is one of the most powerful teachings of the Buddha. It's said that on the night of his enlightenment, the Buddha asked himself, what is the source of suffering? And then he saw it as a sequence of links of causes and effects. And there's 12 classic links that one leads to another. So in the sutra that we chant, again, there's a shorthand. So it goes, there is neither ignorance nor extinction of ignorance, dot, dot, dot. Neither old age and death nor extinction of old age and death. So the dot, dot, dot is standing in for the 10 links that come between the first, ignorance, and the last, old age and death. So these 12 links are cyclical and lead to an endless circle of dissatisfaction that creates the unenlightened life or suffering. So escaping samsara and reaching enlightenment occurs when we break these links. And if we break any link in the chain, we are released from samsara, as the chain is useless once one link is broken. And the 12 links are illustrated in the outer ring of the wheel of life. I wish I had a poster of it here. I didn't bring one. Probably most of you have seen it. It's beautiful. Colorful depiction, and on the outside of it are the 12 links of causation, and they're as followed. So the first one is ignorance. This is something we're all very familiar with. It means not understanding the Four Noble Truths, in particular that life is dukkha, that it is unsatisfactory or stressful. It's ignorance of the teaching of no self, and in the diagram, it's illustrated as a blind man or woman. And the second link, which the first one leads to, is samskara, or volitional action or impulses. So as we don't understand the truth, we have impulses that lead to actions that continue us along a path of samsaric existence. And this is depicted as potters making pots. And then the third link is vijnanya, conditioned consciousness, brought to us from the six senses and sense fields interacting. And it's represented by a monkey leaping thoughtlessly from one thing to another, distracted and tempted by sensations. And the fourth link is nama rupa, the five skandhas, the moment when matter meets mind. So it's the artificial assembly of the five skandhas, aggregates, to form the illusion of a person with individual existence. And it's represented by people in a boat traveling through samsara. The fifth link is the six senses, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind, represented by a house with six windows. And the six links, sense impressions, contact between a sense and a sense object. That's depicted as a couple embracing. The seventh is Vedana, inspired by sense impressions, feelings of something being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And this is illustrated as an arrow piercing an eye to represent sense data piercing the senses. Very vivid. And the eighth one, and this one, just to make note of this one, Trishna, is desire or craving inspired by the Vedana, moving towards what is pleasant to us and away from what is not. On the wheel, this is illustrated as a man drinking beer, often surrounded by empty bottles. And number nine, what the craving leads to, upadana attachment, how we cling to the illusion of ego and a sense of individual self. It all also represents clinging to a womb and thus the beginning of rebirth, endless cycle. So it's illustrated as a monkey or a person reaching for a piece of fruit. Number 10, bhava, becoming. The force of attachment keeps us bound to samsara, the life to which we are familiar, as long as we don't break our chains. And this is depicted as a couple making love, or a woman in advanced pregnancy, which then leads to number 11, birth, shown as a woman giving birth. And birth inevitably leads to number 12, which we're familiar with in the sutra, old age and death, illustrated with a corpse. So if we break one link of this chain, we are free from the endless cycle of samsara. But if the links of the chain do not include a self, then it is already broken. Thus, neither ignorance nor extinction of ignorance, until no old age and death, nor extinction of old age and death. If there is no causation in the first place, there cannot be an end of causation. So the Four Noble Truths teach us that release from the cycle of samsara is possible. And they're the next lines of the sutra, which are also negated. No suffering, no cause, no cessation, no path. So the Four Noble Truths were the subject of the Buddha's first sermon after he reached enlightenment. And they are like, kind of like the Coles Notes version of the 12 links of causation, actually. And it's like he kind of looked at the cause of suffering, saw all the links, and then was giving his first talk and went, well, that's a little complicated. I'll simplify it. So it's the first one, truth is acknowledging that there is suffering. And then seeing that the cause of suffering is thirst or desire that leads to attachment. So here he picked one of the causes from the 12 links, the eighth one, desire or craving. And then the third noble truth is that the cessation of suffering, if we can put an end to thirst and attachment, we can break the chain. Suffering will end. The fourth truth is the path that teaches us how to end attachment, the way through. So again, why the no? These four noble truths seem very sound. They're the result of intense years of practice and realization by the Buddha. But looked at through the eyes of emptiness, or prajnaparamita, in emptiness there is no self that suffers. There is no suffering, no cause of suffering, no relief or cessation of suffering, and no path leading to the relief from suffering. So this is how Avalokiteshvara interprets the Four Noble Truths. And this is followed by no knowledge and no attainment. When we see something that we want to attain, we seek after it. We're always searching and then always needing to maintain what we attain. Enlightenment is not separate from delusion, not separate from us. It is not something we need to chase. We can just rest in no knowledge and no attainment. With nothing to attain, a bodhisattva relies on prajna paramita, and thus the mind is without hindrance. Without hindrance, there is no fear. So we fear what we cannot see. When our mind is clouded with beliefs, desires, habits, and delusions, we cannot see reality clearly. We can't see our true nature, the nature of impermanence. To read from Thich Nhat Hanh again. In the mountains of Vietnam, there are caves where many thousands of birds make their nests. In the early morning, the birds fly out to look for food to bring back for their young. Sometimes the mouth of the cave is obscured by a passing cloud, and the birds cannot find their way home. Only when the bright light of the sun melts away the clouds can the birds see clearly the entrance to the cave and come home. So if our minds are not clouded with beliefs and hindrances, we can see our way home to our true nature. Edward Conze, who's a German philosopher and a scholar of Marxism and Buddhism, and he made an amusing observation about Aristotle, who was famous for the dialectic of contradiction. And I guess somebody was questioning it. So Conze says, Aristotle pointed out in his essay, Metaphysics, that the rejection of the principle of contradiction must lead to the conclusion that all things are one. This seemed to him manifestly absurd. So here, conversely, the insight into oneness of all, the insight into the oneness of all is the great goal, and only by contradictions can it be attained. So there's a sweet story about a monk and his nose that gives me great comfort, as it makes me feel I'm in good company with my understanding of the Heart Sutra. I'll just read that. So we're coming to the end of part two here. The Novice Monk and His Nose. The Zen master asked the novice monk, "Tell me about your understanding of the Heart Sutra." The novice joined his palms and replied, "I have understood that all the five skandhas are empty. There are no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, and no mind. There are no forms, no sounds, no smells, no taste, no touch, and no objects of mind. The 18 realms of phenomena do not exist. The 12 links of interdependent arising do not exist. And insight and attainment also do not exist. Do you believe this?" "Yes, I truly believe this." "Come closer," the Zen master instructed the novice monk. As the novice drew near, the Zen master reached out and grabbed his nose and twisted it hard. In great pain, the novice cried out, "Master, you're hurting me." The Zen master raised his eyebrows questioningly. They always have eyebrows. But you just said that the nose doesn't exist. So that if there is no nose, then what's hurting?" That is the question. So I hope that some of my musings may have opened some doors of insight into this sutra for you. And I apologize for any misguided or confused thoughts I have put forth. And I'm going to end with a little tune. Last week, Flo mentioned Joni Mitchell, a great Dharma teacher, whose song Woodstock tells us that we are stardust. And I think she was clearly a student of the Heart Sutra, because there's also both sides now. "I've looked at life from both sides now, from win and lose, and still somehow it's life's illusions I recall. I really don't know life at all." So I offer any merit from this talk to the people of Ukraine and all of those affected by and suffering in this war. May there be peace. May